This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. On this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best,
is the banking crisis a force multiplier for credit tightening?
Whatever you thought the recession risks were 2 weeks ago, it has to be higher today.
Could rising interest rates trigger a more widespread problem?
How do you adjust asset prices if yields are going to be much higher than what you thought 2 years ago or 1 year ago?
And the tech industry, traumatized by the failure of SVB.
No one thought too hard about, is my bank safe? Is my bank secure? And now I think the prevailing sentiment is that folks who were might have otherwise taken a more laid-back approach here have become effectively financial preppers.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week, powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
You know, Ed, investors will be getting reports this coming week on inflation and also on economic growth.
Yeah, right, Denise. Helping set the stage for what comes next for the Fed after Chair Powell hiked interest rates another quarter point this past week and said more could come. But
for now, though, we see the likelihood of credit tightening. We know that that can have a, you know, an effect on the macroeconomy, on demand, on labor market, on inflation, and we're going to be watching to see what that is. And we'll also be watching it what's happening with inflation and in the labor market.
Meantime, Diane Swank, chief economist over at KPMG, says Powell is really leaving things up in the air. And she says he left all options open.
I think that the Fed is basically saying we just don't know how much credit tightening is in the pipeline and we're willing to do whatever is necessary.
Meantime, Kathy Jones, chief fixed income strategist at the Schwab Center for Financial Research, says the credit tightening you heard Powell mention, well, is something we'll see all too soon.
Credit availability is always a crucial indication of where the economy is going. You know, in periods where credit is widely available, standards are loose, as we've had for quite some time, you get, you know, a lot of expansion in the economy. And we've turned that corner. We turned that corner late last year. The question is now, how fast do we go from here in terms of tightening credit standards and tightening credit conditions? I think that it goes fairly quickly because of what we've experienced in the last couple of weeks. Anybody running a small to medium-sized bank, let alone a large bank, has got to be looking at this and saying they need to be cautious to avoid being the next one that gets a run on the bank and has to go to the Fed, the newly created program where they can pledge the assets and pay 10 basis points for it. Now, nobody really wants to be the one that has to go there.
And Ed, Morgan Stanley Global Balance Fund's co-CIO Jim Caron, though, says the credit tightening that Jones mentioned, well, it's not the end of the world, but risk is heightened.
I think what we have to really distinguish is this a systemic event or is it a heavy blow to confidence? I think it's a heavy blow to confidence. Is it a credit crunch like in 2008 or is it a credit tightening? I think it's a credit tightening. So ultimately, whatever you thought the recession risks were 2 weeks ago, it has to be higher today. Whatever you thought inflation might have been, you know, going forward, it's probably also lower because you're going to have slower growth going forward. So it's really a trade-off in terms of all of the tightening that we may see. It's very, very likely to see in the banking sector and from the banking sector. When does that start to show up in the economy? Is it in the third quarter? Is it in the fourth quarter? Is it right away? Usually these things work with a bit of a lag. And I think that lagged effect is really what's creating the uncertainty. So look, I mean, most people don't expect that we're going to grow more than 1% this year anyways. So if we're going to shave off 0.5% or more, that's actually a meaningful amount, meaning shave off 0.5% given the tightening of credit standards, that creates more of a negative outlook for 2023, and it's something that we need to be concerned about.
Okay, and so that's the view of Morgan Stanley Global Balance Fund's co-CIO Jim Caron on the credit tightening.
And former New York Fed President Bill Dudley, and also a senior advisor to Bloomberg Economics and Bloomberg Opinion columnist, says risk of a hard landing for the Federal Reserve has gone up.
You know, basically, the Fed is saying that one, uncertainty has gone up a lot. We're not really sure how long the banking system stress is going to last and how severe it's going to be. Number two, that stress is going to restrain the economy, and that substitutes a little bit for rate hikes. So we're not going to have to do as much as we thought we were going to have to do earlier. uncertainty has gone up. Certainty has gone up a lot. And I think it's sort of interesting that markets are not really fully focused on that, because the risk of a hard landing is higher now, because the Fed isn't going to really know what's the appropriate policy to do until they get a lot more information. And it's going to take time for that information to be received. And it's not going to be very easy to assess how are these banking woes going to affect credit conditions and how much is that going to affect economic growth. So I think that we're actually in a worse place today than we were a few weeks ago, because they're just, you know, there's two forces. One force is keeping inflation high. Another force is slowing the economy down. And we don't know which one is going to dominate or for how long. So I think the risk of a hard landing has definitely gone up.
Bill, the easy way to dismiss any conversation around the Fed is just to say they're data dependent. I hear that so much. They're going to be data dependent. But Bill, at this point, I'm wondering, what data are they dependent on for the next decision?
Well, I think the problem is that the data on the effects of credit tightening on the economy take a while to actually be realized. You know, we have two sort of open questions about the banking system. Number one, how broad is it going to be? How many banks are going to be affected? Number two, how much are banks that are affected actually going to tighten their credit standards? The problem is not a credit problem. The problem was actually banks taking on too much interest rate risk. So it's not obvious to me that tightening credit standards is really the logical response. And number three, how long is this going to go on? So I think that there's a lot of uncertainty here about how much of a breaking effect the banking system woes are going to be on the economy. You know, the fact that the Fed basically has one more rate hike and then keeps rates high throughout the year suggests that at this point, they don't think that this is going to exert a lot of downward momentum on the economy. What's interesting is the market reaction to the Fed's press conference and the statement and the summary of economic projections was to be ever so slightly surprised by the rate hike, because it wasn't fully priced in. But actually, it's pricing in more rate reduction in the rest of 2023 and into 2024 than they were earlier. And I think that was a little bit surprising, frankly, given the fact that Powell was very clear. We don't expect to cut rates in 2023.
Does that open up a question about the credibility of the Fed?
I think it opens up a question that people are just very uncertain about what the banking system will mean for economic activity, and then how does that actually translate to the Fed. I think, you know, people are, you know, worried about the downside risk from the banking sector.
Steve Chivarone of Federated, I keep going back to this because I think it's a really salient point. This meeting marks the passing of the torch from inflation and duration risks, he wrote, to recession and credit risks. Arguably, what we have seen is not a credit crunch. However, often liquidity crunches can lead to credit crunches, as we've seen in the past. Bill, do you agree that this really is a tipping point as represented to some of the changes in the statement?
I think it really depends on how broad and how long. I mean, you know, we've had other examples where there have been all sorts of market turbulence and no recession resulted. The most obvious example of that was the 1987 stock market crash, where people were talking about making analogies back to the Great Depression, and the economy didn't go into recession at all. So I think the real issue here is how many banks are affected and how strongly do they react? When I look at the U.S. banking system today, I see only a handful of banks that have actually been affected, and they only account for a few percentage points of total banking assets. So I personally think that if this thing is stabilized right here, the effects on the real economy are going to be pretty modest.
So to be clear then, Bill, that's an important point, because we're only 2 weeks into this. If it doesn't spill over and carry on bleeding, are we going to go back to what we were talking about 2-3 weeks ago in another 2 weeks?
We very well can. I mean, I don't think we'll have the clarity in 2 weeks, but, you know, 6 weeks from now, the next FOMC meeting, you know, maybe we're back in the situation where, gee, the banks that were under pressure have either remedied themselves or been acquired, and the rest of the banking system is fine, and the economy is still too strong, and the labor market is still too tight, and inflation is still too high. I mean, the reality is the Fed actually hasn't accomplished much yet in terms of generating more slack in the labor market or actually bringing services inflation down. And that's important to recognize.
So when the Fed chair says we're not thinking about cutting interest rates this year, I guess you're saying we should really take him seriously, because you don't think that's going to happen at all.
Well, there's a wide band around that possible outcome. But I think what he's saying is that job number one for the Fed is to get inflation down to 2%. And they think that's going to be a long, drawn out process, not something that's going to happen very, very quickly. I thought it was interesting in the summary of economic projections, if you look at their forecast, the forecast virtually unchanged from the December meeting. So essentially what they did was economy is stronger than we thought, inflation is higher than we thought. Oh, but we have had some banking system woes. what should we do to our forecast? Well, let's leave it basically unchanged. Because that's a set, and they're doing that because they just don't know which of those two forces predominates.
Final question, Bill. Next decision is May 3rd. Is that enough time to get the incoming information you think they need?
We'll see. I mean, you know, I think it's going to be either the banking system stabilizes pretty quickly in the next few weeks, or we just have, you know, creeping problems. You know, the problem that in the banking system is when the weakest bank gets into difficulty, that raises the stress on everybody else because everyone else gets more skittish.
Yep.
You know, all the people that are using the banks are much more skittish today than they were before the Silicon Valley Bank failed. And so it doesn't take as much bad news today to generate the same response as a couple weeks ago.
And those were some sobering comments there from former New York Fed President Bill Dudley, also a senior advisor to Bloomberg Economics and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz.
Coming up,
the widespread impact we're seeing from the failure of Silicon Valley Bank.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
You know, Denise, as we continue to watch developments with the banking crisis, bank failures, and all the questions about what to do with our assets, some are saying regulators actually responded pretty well to the situation.
Yeah, and one of those with that view is Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser. She says mobile phones really played a role in the bank runs.
So here's Fraser with David Rubenstein at the Economic Club of Washington.
In the old days, when there were bank runs, you used to see people lined up outside the street and get their money out. Now, you're just on your iPhone or whatever phone you have, you can take your money out. So money moves so quickly.
Yeah.
Was that a factor as well in having the money get out of a bank so quickly? You don't have to wait in line. You can just do it over the
It
iPhone?
Is a complete game changer from what we've seen before, David. You're absolutely right. There were a couple of tweets, and then this thing went down much faster than has happened in history. And frankly, I think the regulators did a good job in responding very quickly. Because normally you have longer to respond to this. So they acted with quite a lot of speed given how quickly this happened.
And that was Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser with David Rubenstein at the Economic Club of Washington.
And Wasim Daher, CEO of Pilot, tells our Ed Ludlow and Caroline Hyde, the accounting and bookkeeping platform saw a lot of pain and fear as SVB melted down.
Well, it was very panicked, I can tell you that. And it was panicked on two fronts. One was, of course, for our customers that banked with SVB, which was about half of our customers. They were concerned about the safety of their deposits. But the second order thing that I think many people have not anticipated is the impact this had on our clients being able to make payroll.
Right.
Because if you didn't bank with SVB, but your payroll processor did, you had a problem.
Sunday night, Monday morning, probably more importantly, I had so many phone calls and text messages from VC saying the ADP wire went through. They had access to SVB, but it didn't really mean anything. They were trying to make payroll. Where do you come in that process as basically an accountant?
Sure, so our phone and email inboxes were ringing off the hook to say, hey, what do I need to do here? What funds am I actually going to be able to access? Which ones am I not going to be able to access? Do I have to file a claim with the FDIC? How do I actually make payroll? Can I transfer funds out of a personal account so I can pay my employees? There was just a lot of panic, a lot of uncertainty about tactically, how do I make sure my employees get paid?
You know, Caroline, in the last week or so, what's been put in perspective, for me at least, is we talk about startups, tech, in kind of abstract terms. They're businesses run by people with responsibilities. You know, that's really come out in the conversations we've had.
They are, and that was going to be the collateral damage if a rescue of SVB didn't come in for the depositors. Wasim, the after effects of SVB are that the counterparty risk was so large because they banked the same types of clients. You are a founder dependent on the same types of clients. Pilot is servicing tech startups. Did you suddenly think, oh goodness, I need to diversify my own business?
I mean, one of the things we always think about, the mission of Pilot has always been not to do accounting for technology companies, though it's where we specialize. It's to help every small business owner out with this problem. So we're always thinking about how do we make sure our own customer base is robust against these types of shocks.
Okay, so you haven't suddenly thought, I need to broaden, I need to make my marketing perhaps more of a just early small company, SME, rather than a VC-focused backed sort of a company?
I would say not urgently. I mean, this is always something we're talking about. But we have a number of startup customers who continue to grow and thrive, and we're excited to continue to serve them.
Have you won business because of what's happened? Are there any founders that basically said, I can't do this, I need your help?
I think probably what we did do is do a good job of helping people navigate the crisis. Now, I'd say unlike another provider, if you had another bank, for example, probably lots of new bank accounts were opened as a consequence of all the SVB excitement. It is not the case that lots of new pilot customers showed up at the door, though I think folks appreciated that we kind of were a nice hand-holding guide throughout the process.
And Wasim, a lot of people have said, look, it isn't actually that easy to go around diversifying who you bank with. People want minimums. People want an ability to show the lack of risk in your business model. And that's why SVB was so important to the tech system. What are you now seeing? Are people still with ease changing banks? Are they able to diversify to ensure their treasury management is where they want it to be?
Well, I think a lot of people are now willing to incur a lot more pain here than they were previously, which is before all of the SVB excitement, I think no one thought too hard about, is my bank safe? Is my bank secure? And now I think the prevailing sentiment is that folks who were might have otherwise taken a more laid-back approach here have become effectively financial preppers. Like, they care deeply about making sure, oh, I was shocked by the fact that this was not available for a few days. I now need to make sure this never happens again.
And that was Wasim Daher, CEO of Pilot, with Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow and Caroline Height.
And Denise, you know, the failure of Silicon Valley Bank earlier this month, well, that didn't just affect the tech industry.
That's right, Ed. And Joanna Strober, co-founder and CEO at Midi Health, tells Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde the impact is just incredibly widespread.
You know, like anyone else, it's been a really stressful experience. It was not clear over the weekend whether we would be able to make our payroll the following week. It wasn't clear whether the company would succeed. And so it was definitely a stressful experience trying to figure out how to get everything secured and be sure we'd be able to continue to keep all of our employees. You know, we have employees all over the country, and we wanted to make sure they would still have jobs.
Employees like nurses, health practitioners, you're a women's health startup. You were founded to focus on menopause, on perimenopause in particular. And it's almost the antithesis of what perhaps we all started to think of and got a lot of notoriety during the unfolding of the collapse of SVB. We all thought about these rather lulled, you know, white male tech bros who were on Twitter complaining loudly in all caps. Meanwhile, this was about to affect the broader economy. How has the conversation gone behind the scenes among women, diverse founders, people of color, who perhaps felt that this wasn't a great PR exercise for their industry?
Many of them felt very ignored, quite honestly. When you read Twitter or you read the mainstream media, no one was talking about the healthcare companies or the education companies or the clean technology companies. No one was talking about female founders. All the discussion was about this very small group of very verbal, outspoken men on Twitter who were loudly protesting the fact that their companies would be hurt. But the reality is there are so many more people reflected in Silicon Valley. There were also people who run nonprofits whose money was in these banks. There's people who run camps whose money in these banks. And so none of those people felt heard during this. And I think there was a lot of sense of, wow, like, we have, you know, tens of thousands of employees around the country doing really important things, and no one is talking about us.
And it almost felt sort of insult to injury was that we were just coming off the back, I'm sure you were, of a lot of female-focused events. It was, of course, International Women's Day the week before, and there was a lot of talk about diversity and trying to build that momentum within the tech scene. Among VCs, you used to be one. Among founders, you now are one. And I'm interested as to whether people are now banding together a little bit more to try and amplify voices, rather than just you single-handedly trying to put about op-eds at the moment.
I think there's a lot of sense that we need to be part of the story, right? That we need to be part of the narrative, and the women realize that they need to be a much bigger part of the discussion about what's going on in Silicon Valley. The percentage of women who are funding companies is increasing. The percentage of women who are founding companies are increasing. And we need to be part of that narrative. We need to be in the mainstream press and not just doing this quietly behind the scenes. We need to be much more verbal about what we're doing. And I think there's certainly a sense of a lot of founders that we need to be expressing much more about the importance of our companies and the importance of our companies to the overall nation, because these companies are making a really big impact in all sorts of areas, including education and healthcare. And we need to make sure those voices are amplified.
Joanna Strober, co-founder and CEO at Midi Health, with Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde.
And coming up, Kathy Wood on what the banking failures mean for tech and the economy.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. You know, Ed, the tech industry, as we've been reporting, really got hit hard, understandably, by the failure of Silicon Valley Bank.
Now, Denise, Kathy Wood, CEO and CIO at the tech-focused ARK Invest, talks about the impact on Bitcoin and also tells Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde, Ned Ludlow, that more shoes could drop in the banking industry.
Well, I think they're addressing the liquidity issue, but not really the solvency issue from our point of view. A couple of things have happened here that have never happened really in history, and so the banks didn't expect it. The first was interest rates up 19-fold in less than a year. Never happened. Under Volcker, which it was twofold, 10 to 20%. And the low base does matter. Many people dismissed it, saying, oh, just such a low base. No, expectations were low base. So that was the first. We've never seen that magnitude of an earthquake, I would say. Then the second thing that no one expected, again, because it hasn't happened in such a long time, was deposits leaving the system. For Silicon Valley Bank, it was venture capital facing a funding drought, and so they had to draw down their deposits. But then for others, you've got money market funds attracting, paying much higher than deposits, attracting flows. So that combination was lethal. And so now they have the backstop in. Now what do we have? We have the they're going to be paying up if they're depending on the facility. They'll pay roughly 4.37% right now is that rate, OIS plus 10. And that's much higher than many of them have been paying for deposits, number one. While in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, their average held to maturity security on the asset side of their balance sheet was only 1.6. So they're going to see net interest losses. Now, instead of having mark-to-market hit equity, these losses are going to hit earnings.
Kathy, that's the cause. Let's go to the effect. You cite the Fed as the cause. How nimble are ARK being? How much are you recalculating your view going forward?
Well, as we said before COVID, as we were descending into that, and we are saying now, innovation solves problems. Some of the innovators out there are solving problems. I mean, I think the most dramatic example of it to us was the behavior of Bitcoin last week. It absolutely took off. It was a flight to safety vehicle. And so it is really proof of concept that innovation solves problems. There are, in Bitcoin, fully decentralized, fully transparent, auditable, which is addressing all of the banking's problems right now. And so a flight to safety, a little bit of an insurance policy. There's no central point of failure in Bitcoin.
Caroline, ARK has 2030 calls on Bitcoin, the most bullish case around 1.5 million on Bitcoin, the most bearish around 250,000 on Bitcoin. Somewhere in the middle, you have around 682,200. That is the sort of base case there. Interesting at a time when no one is making that kind of long-term projection.
Yeah, and Kathy, we know you're a long-term investor with long-term calls, but what on earth gets us to that bull case of almost $1.5 million per Bitcoin if a bank crisis doesn't?
One of the things that happens in a crisis is liquidity dries up. So that tends to hurt assets. And the fact that Bitcoin moved in a very different way from the equity markets in particular was quite instructive. You'll find the building blocks of those price targets in our Big Ideas 2023. So ARC Big Ideas 2023, and they are, for the base case, I would suggest quite conservative. We've dialed some of them down since last year. I know that corporate treasuries pulled away from Bitcoin because the regulators were pulling them away from Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So we've pulled back there. But we do believe that the behavior of the price through this crisis is going to attract more institutions, for example. We've done a report targeting institutional investors and the allocation that they should make if they care about this new asset class diversifying their portfolios. And I believe it's somewhere between 2.5% and 6.5%. So not crazy. These are the sorts of allocations they would have made to emerging new categories of assets like real estate in the 70s, emerging markets and small cap in the 80s and 90s.
What do you say to those that have a shorter time frame in terms of investing, those that are looking to retire in the next 5 to 10 years? Should they be with you, or do we have to be long-term equity investors that have a much longer runway to have exposure to ARK investments?
So we're the closest thing to a venture strategy, to a venture capital fund in the public equity markets. And a venture fund has a long-term investment horizon. If an investor cannot have that long-term an investment horizon, then they should allocate perhaps a small amount to our strategy, say 1% or 2%, which, by the way, from what we can tell, most advisors have us at that 1% to 3% range. Now, why would you put any? It is because our companies are going to disrupt the traditional world order. And if we're right, then the large cap benchmarks, right, and even some of the mid cap funds are going to be disrupted. We will be a hedge. Now, I submit to you that last year was the most unusual year of my investment career, and not only mine, but bond investors. So bond investors had the worst year in 200 and some odd years. When interest rates go up 19-fold in less than a year, it's going to kill long-duration assets. Bonds are long-duration assets. They've never seen a year like that. ARK is a long-duration asset. But if we're right and these companies are going to disrupt the traditional world order, then we want to be on the right side of change, and the market will come our way, away from those benchmarks, which represent the traditional world order, to our strategies.
For our global radio audience, we're speaking with Cathy Wood, CEO of ARK Investment Management. Cathy, in June on stage at Up Summit, you cited retail inventory levels, and you told me, if you remember, that inflation would unravel. Did you get that one wrong?
No. If you look at upstream, what's going on? Commodity prices are coming down quite dramatically, some by 70-80%. And I would also say the retail call was very right. I think you'll agree on that. The discounting, we think, is going to continue to work its way through the system from the commodity price level to downstream near the consumer. And you can see this. Tesla is cutting prices. Many people say, oh, it's because of competition. No, it's because their commodity prices are coming down. And Elon's even talking about deflation. And the cost associated with innovation is coming down because it follows a learning curve. So I think the innovation that our companies are delivering are going to be one part of the deflation. Commodity prices and another. And I will also tell you, the yield curve, the week before last was down, inverted by as much more than 100 basis points. That also is a deflationary signal, as is what's now going on in the banking system. Yes. I think the banking system is fearing deflation.
And that was Kathy Wood, CEO and CIO of ARK Invest, with Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow.
And we'll get a little bit more of an upbeat assessment from World Bank President David Malpass.
And that is coming up right here on Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, Silicon Valley Bank's former parent declared bankruptcy on March 17th.
Yeah, and it's not lost, Ed, on those who have been watching financial markets for a long time, that it was March 16th, back in 2008, that Bear Stearns had its near miss with bankruptcy and sold itself to JPMorgan Chase at the outrageously low price of, what was it, $2 a share?
And Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz had a chance to ask David Malpass, former highly rated economist at Bear Stearns and currently head of the World Bank, how strong the parallels are between then and now. And here's what he told her.
The parallels are there was really a maturity mismatch at some institutions, and the Fed had been raising rates. Remember, a long period of rate hiking leading into 08. But then some big differences. One is this time, the discount window is available to the major institutions. That wasn't the case then. And so that gives some backstop, and you're seeing it really play out now. And another big difference is the Fed itself is buying huge amounts of duration, and other central banks are as well. ECB and Bank of Japan are holders of giant amounts of duration, which wasn't the case in 2008. At that time, remember, central banks only owned treasury bills. So that creates a different complexion to the market and a different set of tools that the regulators have to intervene. So today, I think the big issue is, where is growth going to come from into the future?
I want to talk about the similarities. You talk about a liquidity mismatch. A lot of people draw the distinction. A liquidity mismatch is not a credit crisis, is not a credit crunch. But back in 2008, and actually I would argue earlier, the liquidity mismatch led to a credit crunch. How close is that sort of direct parallel, this sort of direct bleed over into credit conditions?
As interest rates are held down, which was the case in 04, 05, 06, and now in this current or over the last 10 years, then that causes asset prices to go up. So there's a workout period after that. So I think that's what we're in now. How do you adjust asset prices if yields are going to be much higher than what you thought 2 years ago or 1 year ago? And that's the challenge facing the market. How do you allocate the losses? I'm hoping that they don't go to the poor, to developing countries, and to average taxpayers. An issue is, if you've created all that asset price boom, can the losses be allocated back into the same markets? And that's a big challenge.
So could you elaborate a little bit on the disproportionate holding of the burden that you see in some of the developing nations that may affect the growth profile of the world?
Over the last 10 years or so, there was this big concentration of wealth in a narrow group in the advanced economies. That was fueled by both the fiscal deficits, the huge run-up in the debts across the advanced economies, and also the central banks themselves buying duration. And so that leaves not enough capital elsewhere in the world. We've seen the slow growth in developing countries, in part because there's not good access to global capital markets. And now going forward, the challenge is a lot of the world's capital is going to be used by the advanced economies to keep rolling over the debt. So a big challenge for billions of people around the world is, where is there going to be available capital? They have this big population growth in many countries, and yet the capital goes to countries that have declining populations.
So how much does that lower your projection for global growth?
We had lowered it substantially a year or a year and a half ago, recognizing that there was, that, you know, inflation really was a challenge, that the central banks were going to be raising, cost of capital goes up, so growth forecasts go down. So in the latest, what we've seen is advanced economy growth expectations had gone up some late last year. That's the U.S. and China in particular, as China lifted the lockdown. And so as we're looking at it now, the growth is slow but positive in advanced economies, but in developing countries, not much investment taking place.
And that was David Malpass, president of the World Bank, with Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz.
So that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg. And stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.